The Movie Files, a podcast featuring behind-the-scenes tales of motion picture history. Sponsored by Aplomb Publishing. Visit us on the web at www.aplombpublishing.com.
Oh, welcome back to the Movie Files. I am John William Law, your host. We are back talking about James Bond again. I do like talking about the films in the series. I've tried to read a good bit about the series, so I know kind of the franchise. No, I wouldn't say I'm any stretch of the imagination an expert. I am a big fan, and I'm a movie buff, so I do like reading about stories behind them. So I have a bunch of books on Bond, and I've read stuff. I don't always, I have to be honest, I do sometimes do a little bit of research before I record a podcast so that I kind of have some of my stuff straight in my head, because having kind of written about movies and read about movies and so many different movies over the years, it's really hard to kind of keep all your facts straight. And certainly with the Bond series, it's difficult because you've got such a huge number of films with such very interesting stories that have spanned such a long period of time, you know, in fact, generations of time. It always makes it hard to make sure that I get on my facts straight. But when I do podcasts like this, I try not to treat them like I am reading, a narrative off of, you know, a Wikipedia page or something like that, because I'm trying to make it a little more conversational in terms of kind of a free-flowing type of thing, but trying to interject some of the knowledge or some of the facts and some of the interesting things to make it kind of, you know, if you're watching a film like this, I tend not to go into lots of the details of, oh, what's the story about usually in these cases, because I like to think that if I'm talking about a film that in any way interests you or you haven't seen it, that you might actually go, you know, watch it. So I don't try and give away stories, but I do try and tell enough of the story to kind of give, or enough of the elements of the movie to kind of give someone an idea that, oh yeah, this is something that maybe I want to see or that I should see. License to Kill was the 16th, I believe, of the Bond series. And it is actually interesting in that it actually is the first James Bond movie that is not based on a title of an Ian Fleming story. And story is important in that sentence because not all of the James Bond films were based on an entire novel of James Bond by Ian Fleming. So after the initial set of films, which were based on the novels, as they started to run light on novels and the film franchise was certainly extending beyond the book series, and Ian Fleming had passed away in 1964, they were definitely looking for opportunities to kind of tell the Bond story in a different way. There are a couple of things. After Ian Fleming died, there were a couple of books that were published after his death. Man with the Golden Gun, I think, was the first one, came out not long, within a year after his death. And then Octopussy and Living Daylights were actually short stories. So both of those films were based on, they were in the title of the book, but they were both kind of shorter stories that Ian Fleming, I believe, had never quite completed. So this one would be the first time that they would actually do a James Bond story that was not based on an Ian Fleming book in the title. So License to Kill obviously is what James Bond is. He is licensed to kill. So it seemed like a likely thing. They've done a couple of others. They did The World Is Not Enough a few years later with Pierce Brosnan, was based on a the coat of arms that is on the Bond family crest or something, and it is mentioned in the film on Her Majesty's Secret Service. A License to Kill was originally going to be called License Revoked, and then they altered it. I don't really know the reasoning. I guess License to Kill sounds a little more dramatic than License Revoked. The film is a little bit of a departure for the Bond series in an interesting way. It is the second film with Timothy Dalton as Bond, and the last film with Timothy Dalton as Bond. There are a lot of people out there who stand in various camps in terms of who was the best Bond and who was the worst Bond, and Timothy Dalton rarely gets kind of a lot of credit for his kind of contribution to the Bond franchise. I personally think that he did bring a lot to the franchise, even though he only did two films. And I think that you really have to look at the history of the series to kind of understand where they all fall into place. Because when you look back, everyone does, and I've talked about this on previous podcasts, that, you know, Sean Connery is the quintessential James Bond in many ways, and people kind of harken back to him as the ultimate Bond because he really did create the franchise. He created Bond on the big screen and has a great deal of credit for that. He gave him life and gave him a swagger and a demeanor and had a lot of, you know, of humor and sex appeal and action hero and all of those things that made Bond so great and really turned the series into the successful franchise it is initially owed to Sean Connery and the creation, the character that he really created and branded. George Lazenby would follow him with one film on Her Majesty's Secret Service, if I can spit that out, in the late 60s, 69. And he was sort of a what I would call a throwaway Bond. He probably had the potential to do more, but there were a lot of other reasons for the fact that he didn't, and I know bits and pieces of them, but I'm not going to go into them here. I actually think I have a podcast on Her Majesty's Secret Service somewhere in the podcast episodes. There's one on the film. But he did one film, and he really did kind of have the same look of a Sean Connery. He really cut from the same cloth. So I think from a visual standpoint, he was an easy transition to almost if you squinted and looked the right way, you wouldn't notice that, you know, Sean Connery had changed to George Lazenby. But obviously he was not an actor, so he didn't bring anything extra to the table. The film is, I like the film. It's a good film and it stands up. And I think it did kind of keep the franchise alive and show that it could survive without Sean Connery. It was not a huge success, but it did very, very well in the box office, actually. Sean Connery would return for one more film, Diamonds Are Forever, and then we would hand the reins off to Roger Moore. Roger Moore brought Bond into his own. I think he showed that the franchise definitely had a long life in front of it, regardless of who was playing Bond, and I think that's one of the things that is to his credit. And I think he also managed to take the character into a slightly different direction with a more suave character, a more almost superhero-like type feats and things that the producers put into the films, which I don't necessarily know that was Roger Moore's doing, but I mean, elevated Bond on a different level. He was this kind of suave, kind of almost floating above everything else. He could do no wrong. And he also had this ability to deliver an element of humor that, while it was always in all the Bonds, I think Roger Moore's really humor became a much more central piece of the stories. As he moved on through the series, he became a little bit old for the character. He and Sean Connery, I think, were almost around the same age. And so by the time that the franchise ended, or for him, his last film, View to a Kill, they were really looking a little old. They really were expecting to get something, you know, a little more of a youthful image in there. So Timothy Dalton had apparently been looked at as a Bond replacement years earlier, and from what I had read, and so they went back to him. And I've got License to Kill. I think there is one on here, so I'm not going to go into this again because I think I talked about it there. But after the success of License to Kill, they obviously quickly went in to create a new film and what the next film in the series was. And License to Kill was going to be a little bit different. They were going to try and take it darker. They wanted it to be a little more darker. I think part of the reason was you started seeing a lot more types of films out there that were kind of sneaking into its space with things like the diehards were coming out, and there was Rambo and there was Lethal Weapon, and there were a lot of these different kind of films that were happening that had these action hero characters, but they were a little darker. And well, they had elements of humor and action and all the other things that made up Bond. They were a little different. They weren't as quite as, you know, as adventure, you know, above the superhero kind of, you know, fantasy-like as the Bonds were. So I think they wanted to kind of take the films into a slightly new level with License to Kill. One other difference in the film I had heard was that when they were originally looking at producing License to Kill, in addition to the darker theme, they wanted to take Bond into some locations that he had never been. And the original story, License Revoked, was going to take Bond into China. And there were some scenes that were written of things like, running or fight scenes on the Great Wall of China and stuff like that. They apparently nixed the idea and decided to take it into Mexico and created some fictional space for it, partly because the movie The Last Emperor had been released and it had already taken viewers into China in a very dramatic way. And The Last Emperor, if you've never seen it, is a very, very, very visual movie, a fantastic movie in terms of its visual take on it. And so from an opening up of China and opportunity, it's strange for us to think of it today this way. But if you go back to the kind of 1980s and prior to that, you really didn't see a lot of real China in major motion pictures, partly because the Chinese would not allow it to be filmed there. So there isn't that much that we had an opportunity to see. So when they started filming in China and The Last Emperor was that one of the first big opportunities to get a huge visual impact of this is, you know, what China looks like. And it was a very dramatic, a very big film, did a lot of, I think it won a bunch of Academy Awards, if not Best Picture, I can't even remember. But it would seem that when that happened, the makers of Bond decided that, you know, China had sort of been kind of done to the nth degree, to a point where they were never going to achieve the same level of success. So they decided to kind of set the story elsewhere. And then the story did unravel into kind of a drug lord type thing. So it was a little more modern day contemporary drug lord and going into places like Colombia and Nicaragua and that type of stuff. So it was a very gritty, almost like a crime, I wouldn't say a mob crime, but in a drug cartel type of crime story. So the one thing that's also interesting about the story is that David Hedison played Felix Leiter many years earlier in the first Roger Moore film, Live and Let Die. And he is the only person, he was the only person, I should say, to play Felix Leiter, the American CIA agent, two times on the big screen. Actor Jeffrey Wright, who is now, I guess, better known for his work in Westworld, played Felix Leiter in two films now. So he played him in Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. So he does kind of have that kind of fact now to own as well. So it's not just David Hedison. But David Hedison played the role in quite a number of years apart. I think it was something like 14 years or something like that, between his kind of takes on Felix Leiter. He plays on his wedding day. In the film, his wedding day is marred with when his wife and he are both attacked and his wife is killed by these evil kind of drug cartel kingpins who are out to get him because of their getting in their way of their criminal activities. And the story, the darkness of the story really comes from in the part that they attempt to kind of spin the story into this kind of dramatic angle, partly because the James Bond character lost his wife at the end of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. She is shot literally on their wedding day. So this story, which takes place many years later, is sort of a stark reminder. And so Bond goes off on this kind of effort at getting vengeance for this wrong that has been done to his friend and people he cared about. And so that's where the whole License Revoked came from and the License to Kill kind of comes in. I don't have a ton else to talk about the film. It was not the most successful from what I have, learned. I mean, obviously over the years, it did fairly well in a lot of reviews. People respected and liked the fact that it went darker. When it was released in the summer that was released in, I guess it was 89. It was up against a bunch of films. So there was a Lethal Weapon film out, and there was a Indiana Jones film out, and I think Batman was out at the same time. And so there was a lot of competition. So in American sales in North America, it did not do as well at the box office. It did relatively well in the UK, where Bond probably almost always does well. I think it made, somewhere in the neighborhoods of 17 million pounds or something was what the latest numbers were marked at or something at the time. I don't know what it was. It was less than by inflation today's numbers, it would be, I don't know if it was under, it was under $8 million, I guess, pounds at the time. It would do really well overall. I mean, I think it made 150 million. It made $34 million or something in the U.S. box office, which was not necessarily bad, but compared to a lot of the other films that were out there, it was probably, not. It didn't do as well as some of the earlier Bonds, and so there was some issue there. And Bond would actually go into a dormant phase after this, so there'd be a number of years before they would do another. And so Timothy Dalton as Bond, I think originally there was every intention of him returning to Bond again in the next film, but what happened was that there was a whole bunch of legal issues that got involved with the studio and the producers and the production companies and Eon Production and Broccoli, and would sell his shares and MGM would purchase things, and there was a lot of kind of stuff going on around the future of the franchise that kind of went into limbo, and it took them a number of years before they could kind of regroup, and you wouldn't see GoldenEye, which would be the next Bond starring Pierce Brosnan. You wouldn't see that for, I think it was a good, 6 years or something before they would do the next James Bond. So this would be it for a while. The only other thing that's kind of cool about the film that I think is interesting is that, James Bond, I may have mentioned this before, that the music for the series really did kind of come into its own in the 70s, I feel. And major artists started performing. And so you started seeing people like Paul McCartney and Wings and Carly Simon and Sheena Easton and... there was Aha, and, obviously even today you've got a bunch of other ones. But they always tried to pick kind of major, pop stars at the time to do a Bond theme song. And this one is certainly no exception. They got Gladys Knight to sing the song License to Kill. It was actually her first top 10 British hit. She was on the charts in the UK. It's a good song. It's definitely kind of... harkens back to the original. There's even a little riff of Goldfinger in the kind of backing of the story, and that is a very kind of traditional Bond theme. That's a good kind of version. I like the song, and I think it added something to the story. Apparently, from what I had read, they wanted a different song. They actually hired Eric Clapton to craft a song, but they nixed his idea. It'd be interesting to hear it. I've actually never heard the song that he would have done. The only other thing about the song is there's another song that's at the end, as the credits are rolling at the end, there's a song by Patti LaBelle called If You Ask Me To, which actually was probably a bigger hit than the Gladys Knight theme song, but it runs at the end of the film as the credits are rolling. So as people were leaving the theaters, that song would be on, and a lot of people missed it if they didn't know that actually came from License to Kill. So that's a little bit of a look at License to Kill. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.